I'm Alex Roy, and welcome to the Atomicast here with my favorite co-host, as usual, Ed Niedermeyer. Say hello, Ed.
Hello.
And we have, and I say this almost every week, but it's true this time, one of the coolest people who's ever lived, who's lived a life similar to mine, except about halfway into it, he began doing really great things. Dan Greenewalt, the creative director and founder of Forza Motorsport. Thank you so much for coming, Dan.
It's really happy to be here.
So the reason Dan is here is because almost everyone I know who owns a car, loves driving, or dreams of owning a car has played Forza Motorsport. We're now in its seventh iteration, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people I know who invest in self-driving car startups race cars, and they play a variety of simulators ranging from professional, like low-volume, very expensive simulators, but 100% of them have played Forza Motorsport. And it's really the gold standard in a lot of ways, because it's the entree for a lot of kids into cars, just understanding the differences between cars. We'll start with the easy question. How does one become the creative director and founder of a franchise like this, which is so influential and so important in the future of driving and gaming and simulation?
Well, it's been a hell of a ride, and I got to say, like most great rides, it was completely unplanned. I mean, there's no playbook, there's no roadmap for doing what we do at Forza, and certainly not for my career. I've gone and spoken. I've had the chance to speak in front of Boys and Girls Clubs of America and Cub Scouts. I like, you know, kind of speaking to a new generation that's going to be coming into games and coming into cars. And the one thing is clear is that I am not a role model for how you get into this. So I was a religion major in college. I taught martial arts, and those worked. That was going to be my career. I just figured I was going to teach martial arts, and that was going to be my thing. And as you can see, it wasn't. I started working in games to pay the bills, because teaching martial arts didn't really do it. I had classes in the morning before people went to work that had jobs, and I had class at night when people were done with their jobs. And I figured in the middle of the day, I may as well just get a job, because I need to pay the bills too. And so I started working testing games.
What year was this?
This would be 97. So yeah, 20 years ago. I liked the work. It was interesting. And my martial arts studio was not taking off the way I liked. It became a really interesting area, and I tend to throw myself at things. So it went from making games like Midtown Madness on the PC, Monster Truck and Motocross, a lot of madness titles were made on the PC, into Project Gotham Racing on the original Xbox, and then eventually we made Forza Motorsport the first, and since then there's Forza Horizon as well. So there's been multiple expressions of Forza.
There are people who've been building driving games for a long time, but one of the most interesting things about Forza is that manufacturers began releasing vehicles and marketing brands in-game. And so a lot of brands that weren't available to anyone at any age in the United States became known to American players, because that's the largest market. Am I correct?
It is still, yeah.
For the first time, via the Forza platform. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and actually I should amend that. Actually, China is the biggest audience.
Okay.
The biggest audience for a standard Western title that we usually talk about, a premium $60 game, is still the United States. You know, if you think back, you know, Gran Turismo, before that even Ferrari 355 by Yu Suzuki, I mean, these were games that really pushed what simulation could mean for a console audience, for a mass audience, right? And Gran Turismo, I think, built in many ways the mystique around the GTR. This would have been back in, I don't know, 95 maybe? Mm-hmm. And the reason we have the, you know, Godzilla and the GTR today is because the American consumers' hunger and interest in it was able to rekindle it. That was then. It's moved on so much more greatly from there. I mean, I've been making Forzas for 13, 14 years now, and the relationship with the car industry has fundamentally changed. It started with, we were just a licensing thing, you know, like, hey, we make Hot Wheels cars, we license it out, we get a revenue, you know, a little bit of revenue from that. That's how games were thought of. And gamers were kids in their mom's basement, you know, and that was never true, but we couldn't get the auto manufacturers to think differently. Now, when we have millions of players playing every single month, and proof that they build real brand loyalty, so they don't even drive yet, but they know when I drive, I'm going to get an Audi, or I'm going to get a BMW. Building that kind of affinity is incredibly powerful. And now the auto manufacturers come to us. I mean, we debuted the North American debut of the McLaren P1. It was at E3. You know, this is a halo car for McLaren, rebuilding itself out of its kind of ashen days, right? We had the Ford GT. We also debuted. We were part of that debut in Detroit, and then we had its West Coast debut here at E3 in this convention center. And then just recently, the 911 GT2 RS, which had its world debut in front of a gaming audience. Who would ever think Porsche would lead the automotive industry in forward thinking towards the younger generation or gaming?
I don't think people outside of maybe the marketing arms within some manufacturers, I don't think people in general understand the scale of how big the audience is of players for this game. And can you give us a sense of what the numbers have been over time and what they are now?
Yeah. So we started with first off, our team was about 24 people making the first Forza Motorsport. It's a small team. And now there's over 500 people working on Forza around the world all year round making these games. So the scale of the game has changed. The scale of the community has radically increased. I mean, we've gone from measuring our audience in the first Forza in hundreds of thousands to now measuring our monthly audience in September at 7.9 million unique players. So none of these are double counted, playing in the Forza world. So these are all racers building that affinity with cars.
You must have vast amounts of data on specific models people want to drive, how much they want to drive them, modifications, the colors they use, the liveries. Mm-hmm. And is that something that you resell back to manufacturers?
We don't, actually. Yes, there is tremendous opportunity for selling data. It's not something that's actually our business. Our business is entertainment, and we actually do well entertaining people, and so that's what we've kept our business. It's not a business-to-business relationship. It's a business-to-customer relationship. So, yes, we do look at that data, but honestly, the more interesting part is we can create that data. So the first car I give you in the game is the game you're going to play the most. It's also going to be the one you build your largest affinity with. So we can change which cars people build their affinity with by how they show up in people's garages in the game.
Could you identify like a tipping point, especially the relationship with the automakers and sort of the appreciation of this power that you wield? What was sort of at what point did that kind of maybe start to change?
I would say on Forza Motorsport 3, we had a relationship with Audi. And Audi at that time was really trying to remake their brand and really push the other German manufacturers aside. So they were doing things like Iron Man cameos, and Audi was kind of showing up all over the place, and they were being a little bit more loose about whether they're in the good guy car or the bad guy car. They just wanted exposure and coverage. So the V12 Audi R8, they had a prototype of that. They were going to be going to Le Mans. You know, they had the Audi R8 program, the race car program, and they were doing the R10. We started working with these guys very closely, and that was really the tipping point. I think all the other manufacturers were like, oh, we want to have the footprint of Audi. What are they doing? Oh, they're on the cover of this game. Oh, they're showing up at Le Mans with this team, this gaming team. I think that really changed everybody's minds.
All the car magazines that have been around for 50, 100 years, however long it is, appear to be decreasingly connected to the next generation of drivers, of kids who dream of driving. And in Western culture, and actually now globally, the driver's license has become the rite of passage that previously might have been hunting or you know, killing a shark. You know, your driver's license is the thing. Do you see platforms like Forza replacing traditional automotive media as the primary method of educating and delivering brands and models to the next generation of drivers?
I think when you look more broadly at gaming and social platforms, we're now moving beyond even social platforms like Facebook into things that are streaming, like Twitch and Mixer. So I think when you think holistically about Forza and racing games and streaming such as Twitch and Mixer, and you take those two together, you're speaking to an audience in a fundamentally different way than we used to with push media, be that magazines, or it could be movies, or it could be TV shows, traditional motorsport, the way that that's broadcast on a Sunday and it's a big fanfare thing. That's just not how a younger generation is consuming their entertainment. entertainment is now social, and it's social in a way that often our generation can't really grok. You know, you and I are being social when we're face-to-face. We're social when we're at the bar. We're social when we're together. Well, this audience is social in the exact same way in their mind as we think of social when they're actually watching a YouTube stream together, or when they're watching a live Twitch stream and they're chatting with each other or interacting with the actual podcast, or not the podcast, but the streamer on something like Mixer. So that is a level of social interaction in media that we just haven't seen in the past. And there's a whole generation growing up with that not being neat or new. That's just how they do it. Forza's in the heart of that, because what are you doing? You're not just sitting there streaming nothing. You're streaming something. You're streaming doing something. So we're having a shared experience. So that shared experience can be an eSport game, a shooter game, or it could be Forza. And that's what we're seeing a lot of, is that people are not only playing the game and only playing the game against each other, which I think we can kind of understand, but they're watching each other play against each other, and they're chatting, and it's become one kind of sphere of friends hanging out in a digital living room.
I think a lot of people listening to this may not really understand what the experience of putting the game disc in is, all the way to what you're describing. Through every generation of Forza, I'd install the game, and I would go through the training scenarios, you know, and I'd get my cars, and I'd play against the computer to a certain point, but the instant that I jumped the wall into playing against other people, I never wanted to go back. I mean, as good as it was, I had graduated. To me, against the computer, that was the school. And I wanted to be an adult in this virtual world. And so the platform itself is this kind of spine, and then you have all these experiential things, and eventually you get to the grokking in the real world. What is the future of human driving, and when in the real world, self-driving cars become ubiquitous? Is everyone going to move, I guess, this experiential stuff only going to exist through the platform? Or do you see people in the future, kids becoming great drivers in game, wanting to own cars? Because it seems like a lot of people in the real world don't think people are going to own cars in the future.
Because it's fun to talk this way. It's a little bit hyperbolic to be the end of this and the end of that. You know, we have buses, we have mass transit, and it didn't spell the end of cars, because they function differently in your life. You know, there's bus stops and there's train stations, there's things like that. The idea of ride sharing has great merit, but it doesn't mean that it's going to spell the end of cars. I think what it does is comes in and inserts a new wedge. Just like I don't think that traditional media is going to go away. We have streaming media, which will become greater and greater and greater. Will you be a part of it?
So it seems like one of the things that never gets mentioned in these, and I agree with you, hyperbolic often conversations about the end of cars, is that, you know, one of the things that seems to be really killing passion for cars is the fact that there's so many cars on the road. You get out in your car and, like, what can you do? You sit in traffic, like, most of the time for people who live in big cities. Is part of this, like, just opening up a space for cars to be used like they should be used? Is that kind of one of the things that allows Forza to kindle this passion?
The interesting thing is those performance cars are the zone where the digital world and the real world meet. There are plenty of cars on the road that are appliances today that are not autonomous, that are not electric. You know, it's just a 15-year-old Camry, right, that you can go buy off of Auto Trader for not a lot. That's an appliance, and could that group be removed by autonomous cars and by electric cars? Yes, if the price point's right. Have to bring that price point down and have the appliance. But there are still cars that people choose to buy today for lots of reasons that are over $100,000. And you're right, you couldn't push them on the street. You don't have the skill. You don't have the space. There's too much traffic. It's too dangerous. Those are the cars. That's the enthusiast zone where the digital and the real world mix in a really interesting way. We're able to also give people, though, a democratized version of motorsport. You cannot drive an F1 car. You can't. It won't happen. You can do it in Forza Motorsport, and you can drive it against an Indy car and against a NASCAR and a supercar and a V8. I mean, you can do all of that in one game. So there's the fantasy side that we're able to give people. There's the enthusiast side where the two meet. And then there's the appliance side that we don't replicate in the game. That really exists, and people really have them. And
The driver's education component of Forza, to me, is the most fascinating aspect of the game, because it's what I feel is most lacking in the real world. We all know, I always say the safety doesn't exist, no one cares. But in the game, everyone cares, because you can't actually You have to learn how to drive in game, even if you can already drive in the real world, to understand the physics and the limitations and capabilities of each vehicle. And the driver education aspect, the racing line, the way the line shifts position and changes color, is, I think, the single most important thing, benefit you deliver to humanity. What was the gestation of that system? And has anyone come to you to, I guess, export that to real-world education systems?
So there is a near-optimal line on the track. It's mathematically generated to – it's basically the – if you have a car that's a momentum car, not a heavy braker and not a heavy accelerator, it gives you the optimal line to drive that car. Now, if you're in a car where you're going to want to optimize your front straights by doing deep braking, the line's not going to reflect that. So that line is drawn onto the track in a visual way, like a heads-up display. Now it turns blue when you need to be accelerating, yellow when you should be neutral throttle, and red when you should be braking. Now if I'm honest, it suggests that you brake and turn at the same time. And everyone knows, if you've driven fast, that's not the fast way to drive. So the line is optimal-ish, but it's meant to actually have room for improvement. And that's the really key part. We're not trying to, with our assists, and this is very related to autonomous and semi-autonomous driving. With our assists, we're not trying to make good drivers great or great drivers amazing. We're trying to make bad drivers good or incapable drivers capable. We're not trying to make them fast. In fact, if you turn all the assists off in our game, we have guaranteed that you are faster. Even contentious ones, like in the real world, ABS, right? We were talking to J.R. Hildebrand earlier today. Is JR faster with his foot, or is he faster with ABS? With today's ABS system, I think we can say pretty conclusively, he's faster with ABS. It just is a better system. But in the game, we've engineered it in such a way so that you're faster without it. You're faster without TCS. You're faster without all the assists on it.
Encouraging skill improvement.
Exactly. So we will help you with assists go from incapable to capable. But to go from capable to great or amazing, that's on you. And that's where we get challenges. We challenge players to turn off the assist, get faster, go more quickly. Some of that's optimizing that optimal-ish line. Some of it's how you actually control the car. Those assists, though, include, we basically have lane assist. So we have a braking assist and a steering assist. So you can actually drive Forza Motorsport 7 just by holding the accelerator like an RC car. And it will brake for you, and it will turn for you. It won't accelerate for you, but it will stay kind of close to that optimal line. It doesn't pass cars, so if you want to pass, you've got to take control, and you've got to actually do that. But that's where we're able to start people who really can't drive at that dexterous level, for whatever reason, and push them to go one step further.
It seems so obvious to me that every car sold on the road should have the Forza system built into it. And it can, you can turn it off, assuming you make no mistakes. Like, to me, the optimal functionality of a human-driven accessory car, or any human car, would be the Forza line. And that should be like the Forza safety option package on the Accord, on the Camry, whatever it is. Are they beating down your door to license this technology? Because if you took LiDAR maps of the real world and some basic information on traffic flow, you could have an overlay that does that.
Well, you have seen HUDs, you know, heads-up display that are coming into cars that do, obviously, your speed, right? We've had that since the 80s. But you're starting to see things like navigation, you know, projected on the screen, which is similar to a line. What we're not really seeing is that mixed reality, augmented reality, where the HUD knows your eye placement and can kind of digitally place it on the world. That's more of a technology thing than anything else, and I think we'll get there. I mean, our phones are very close.
You look say at it's a technology thing, but a lot of money is being poured into AR for the purpose of selling you stuff through an augmented overlay as opposed to helping you get there alive.
Yeah, so, that's very true.
So it's really a strategic culture. It's a decision, a business decision, because technologically they could do – if there was any morality, I'm sorry, this is me talk. If there was any morality, decency in the automotive sector, they would not try to sell anyone anything via augmented reality until they had licensed the Forza safety package. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know. I think that safety absolutely is. I mean, you look at the innovations that have come into cars in the last 50 years, and we can't sell the company short. I mean, Volvo, Mercedes pioneers incredible safety technology. I think the business side actually is very interesting, not because I'm a businessman, but I think there's interesting technology that comes into there. When I think about that screen that is your windscreen. And I think about that as the same thing as putting a phone on your face for augmented reality or virtual reality space. There's some crazy business opportunities with, you know, why are there billboards when the billboards could be digital?
Have you seen, do you watch Black Mirror?
Yeah.
And you're excited about this?
Yes and no. I think it's exciting because I like technology in general. It doesn't mean I want to necessarily live in that world. But when you talk about like the Forza line being projected, I think first it's thinking about the screen, the windscreen, as an augmented reality screen. And then once you go there, there's all sorts of things you can be putting on there. The brake lights of the car ahead of you could be much brighter. Right? They could be digital brake lights. The whole back of the car could turn red. There's so many more things you could go to once you have an augmented reality screen.
Now, back in the 80s, there was a game called 688 Attack Sub. Do you know this game?
I do not.
Do you know it, Edward?
I know.
On the box, it said that it was the most realistic submarine simulation of all time. I had to have it. So I had it, and my submarine was sunk by the Soviets. And then the game stopped working. And then I read the back of the box. When you were sunk, the game would delete itself from the floppy. Now, that is very realistic for someone who couldn't afford to buy another copy.
But how do you think, how do you believe their complex fluid dynamics of the water going over the hull was?
Very poor.
So is it great simulation?
That's a pretty slippery definition, Mr. Greenwald.
Is it? No, actually, I think this is the real critical bit. What are you looking for out of your simulation? When we look at simulation, we're looking at the physics, first and foremost.
Because you're not a driver's ed app, you're an entertainment app.
Right. And we are looking at having the most cutting-edge physics possible. So that means, like, our tire model is something I would put up against any simulator, be it commercial grade, because we simulate hundreds of tire compounds across 70 years, and our rigid body is not rigid. So we actually have body flex of wooden cars and aluminum cars and carbon fiber monocoque. We simulate all that. The simulation is incredibly complex. But then people can come in and say, well, no, the reason I'm simulating is I just want to slam cars into walls and see how they explode. And, you know, there was a game called Burnout Paradise, which was great for that. It was awesome, right? You smash cars into walls, boom, they blow up. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's a question of what you value in the simulation you're trying to get entertainment from. If what you value is, I want risk and reward, that's it. That's the simulation, is pure risk and reward. Not necessarily skill, not necessarily the simulation of the physics.
Even the earliest versions of Forza had these AI drivatars. And you have to drive against somebody. And in the past, you know, in-game AI was horrible. But in Forza, it's evolved enormously, and it's fascinating. Can you just tell us a little bit about the AI you developed, when that began, how that evolved, and then what relationship you may or may not have with manufacturers today?
So I'm never quite sure how deep to go on some of these things.
It's up to you.
I will say that it's a machine learning system. Mm-hmm. It's called a Bayesian learning neural network. So it basically takes tables and tables of data, and it's able to correlate that data and bake it down. That was the first Forza Motorsport AI. It was done by Microsoft Research in Cambridge. That is one of the things that most game companies don't have the ability to go to Microsoft Research.
What year was that?
That would have been 2002, probably. And have full research people apply pressure to this the way that they would if it were granted by a government. It's amazing, and we've actually worked with research over multiple times, different subjects over the years. It gives us the ability to do things in games that no game company really can. I'm even sometimes amazed, like, we're doing that? We have it. Anyway, so the Drivatar came out of that effort with MSR Cambridge. Now, over the years, we've evolved it, because at the time, we were taking advantage of the hard drive. This was big technology back in the original Xbox. A console with a hard drive? What would you do with a hard drive? Well, we could fill it up with data, and we could have a local AI machine learn off that data. Really revolutionary for 2002 to 2005. When we moved to the Xbox One, we were able to do more with the cloud. So we were able to create it from just a local data set to a truly massive big data set. So you imagine these 7.9 million players, each one is putting in data. You know, they drive on Laguna, they drive on Long Beach, they drive on Watkins Glen. They took a line.
George Hoth must be crying right now.
Well, they lay down lines, and they have tendencies. Do they tend to go wide? Do they break early? Do they break check? There's even racecraft elements of how they actually race with each other. We're able to take all that data, and the machine learning now resident in the cloud on servers is able to look at it and correlate now a much broader data set. It learns things. Initially, it was learning things we actually didn't necessarily want it to learn, and that's the nature of big data, is that it learns things. We have since kind of, I'd say, reined it in so that it's now has, I guess you'd like say, shackles. There's certain areas that AI is not allowed, things it's not allowed to learn. But the fundamental difference between these companies making autonomous driving and what we're doing is because we're in the virtual world, there are things that our AI can know and was born knowing. It knows the grip of the car. It knows everything about that track. It knows how much friction is underneath its tire to the, you know, nth degree at any second of the time. AI in the real world doesn't know that. In fact, that's mostly what it's learning. Most of the AI in the real world is learning all that stuff. What does it mean when I feel this many G's? What does it mean when I'm that close to the curb? Here, our AI knows what it means. It means I'm going to slide if I push the throttle even a slight amount more.
So with all that data that it's aware of, the context of the racecraft, how difficult is it to teach these AIs decent racecraft?
It's really, really hard. So traditional AI in games follows a line. Our AI follows a line too. That part is similar. Traditional AI in games, though, just follows that line. Maybe has some amount of reaction it does to you. Maybe, maybe not. Sometimes they just become traffic cones, basically driving on the track, following their line. Maybe the authors have put two or three lines on the track, this is typical within racing games, so that they can switch almost like slot cars from line two to line three, and that's how they pass you.
Weak.
It's not weak. That's good, optimal use of the CPU in your game. So we do have to make games for real consoles. Our AI is able to follow multiple lines. Those lines are generated by the people who really created them. When you get to racecraft, you actually get into an area of real AI learning that's really hard. Now, part of it is the AI has to see, and it has to forecast, I know what he's going to do. That is the hardest part, and that's where our AI, our drivatars, get into the most trouble. They might see you, so it's tracking, let's say, three cars. I've got two other drivatars on one side of me, and I've got the human on the other side. It should know what those other two cars are doing because they're also part of the system. It does not know what you're going to do. And it is very bad at figuring out what you're going to do. And we, as humans, are very capable of ascribing blame and emotion to every time somebody hits me. So when we'll have our drivatar actually is just, it's taking the line. It knows you're there. But it has decided, I have the right of way. You can go fuck off. Well, when it's made that decision, and you try and come into that corner, it's going to defend that line. People, oh, he doesn't see me. Well, he might see you.
How many millions or tens or hundreds of millions of miles of data do you have?
I have no concept.
Billions? Hundreds of millions?
I have no concept. Honestly, I really don't. Because what we've got is we have tens of millions of unique players that have played the game. So, you know, it's 7.9 in that month. So there's tens of millions that have played the game. And some people don't drive a lot of tracks, and some people drive incessantly. I mean, they're driving all the time. And, I have no idea how much data we have.
Did you know that yesterday Waymo announced that they had surpassed 4 million miles?
And... Oh. 4 million miles that would be a day.
So that's what they've got. And let us end, if you care to guess, in what year will they or anyone else have enough miles of data to teach an AI drivecraft in the real world and deploy level 4?
I just want to make sure we're not selling short. The problem set they are solving is an order of magnitude more difficult, because our drivatar is struggling to predict what you will do in a competitive scenario, and there's only one of you. If there were
But it's a closed environment.
If there were 20 of you, and it was not a competitive environment, so it can't even guess your goal. At least the Drivatar can guess. I'm guessing you're trying to be fast. But in the real world, you can't even guess what people are
trying to do.
But
you can assume that there are a number of them who want to be fast for no reason. Do you believe any of the claims that there will be level 4 self-driving cars deployed in 5 years? And ubiquity in 10?
I believe that that is... ubiquity, I think, is an overstatement. But yes, I believe normalcy. Normalcy in 10? Sure. Meaning we're not surprised by it. The ability to have a car do that in certain situations. I think when you talk full autonomous all the time, 100% of the time, meaning we don't even have to have a steering wheel in it in 5, that seems highly unlikely to me. When you talk about a level of autonomy where there's beyond what we've got right now, where there's large sections you can do it, yeah, it's hard to know. And the other thing is the whole system would get better with hive mind. And you need ubiquity. I don't know when you hit the tipping point where the cars are talking to each other, because then you actually get to that point where, oh, I know what you're going to do because I'm literally talking to you over some sort of near frequency. That will change things radically, but that requires a certain amount of them on the road.
It's really too bad Greenewalt has been nominated by our administration to run NHTSA or DOT. These problems get solved a lot faster. We need to wrap this up because I know you've got another interview. Dan, thank you so much for coming. All right, so if someone's never played Forza, their entree today would be to go out, buy an Xbox, and buy Forza 7?
Yeah, Forza Motorsport 7 on the Xbox One. And we actually just shipped the Xbox One X, mm-hmm. which if you got a 4K TV mm-hmm. and you care, you should get an Xbox One X. The games look on. If you're an audio visuophile, like,
I concur.
Holy.
And do you maintain a blog or anywhere else where people could follow your general thoughts?
Yeah, so most of our community is managed through ForzaMotorsport.net, the website. I'm on Twitter @Dan_Greenewalt. That's easy enough to reach.
That was awesome. I mean, I would love to have you back to talk more about AI and safety. Ed, where can we follow you online?
On Twitter @Tweetermeyer.
And I'm AlexRoy144 on all platforms. And this was Dan Greenewalt from Forza Motorsport. Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.